Hello, Kate Lamb here, and you're listening to Asia Calling. Coming up on the show this week, murder in Myanmar, bloggers in hiding in Pakistan, and exploring the skinhead scene in Indonesia. Welcome to Asia Calling, and thanks for tuning into the show. On the surface, it seemed like a big win for Myanmar, the appointment of Aung San Suu Kyi as head of state after decades of military junta rule. But that milestone is increasingly ringing hollow. Suu Kyi has continued to attract criticism for failing to speak out against alleged abuses of the Rohingya ethnic minority committed by the military. And now, after one of her closest legal advisers was assassinated at Yangon Airport just over a week ago, Suu Kyi is again completely silent. From Sweden, Rick Wasserman has this story.
Nearly 1,000 mourn the death of Kony, Aung San Suu Kyi's legal advisor and a member of her National League for Democracy Party, or the NLD. Kony, an outspoken Muslim lawyer in a largely Buddhist country, didn't shy away from criticizing the powerful role the military continues to hold in Myanmar. The 65-year-old was also an expert on constitutional law and involved in trying to amend the military-drafted constitution.
Ethnic armed organizations, civil society, ethnic political parties, etc., and the army has only allowed them to do this.
Here at this panel on human rights in Myanmar, otherwise known as Burma, Kony's assassination was the talk of the day. A close advisor to Aung San Suu Kyi, observers have been perplexed as to her reaction to Ni's death, or in this case, lack of one. Here's Christian Stoke, a conflict analyst and sociology professor from the University of Oslo.
Regardless of who's behind it, this is clearly a major setback for the reform process in Burma. So I would think that being such a central person, the NLD's legal advisor on constitutional affairs, it's surprising.
Maybe, though, it's not that surprising. Under the veil of a democratic reform process, the military has actually been reversing gains that were made before Aung San Suu Kyi became head of government. The army controls most key infrastructure investment projects, including dams, as well as gas, mining, and electricity, and holds 25% of parliament seats. Suu Kyi has effectively been marginalized, says Liz Tiedemann from the Swedish NGO Burma Committee.
Unfortunately, she has less power than the previous administration, which was, after all, appointed by the army. So this is the problem. We've begun criticizing the NLD government, but we shouldn't forget that the army is the perpetrator and the army is committing all of the attacks. But unfortunately, she's not really in a position to criticize, or she's not criticizing.
It's not only Aung San Suu Kyi that has chosen self-censorship, says Liz Tiedemann with a sigh.
Not so many voices. Unfortunately, one of the dynamics with the National League for Democracy is that they don't allow their MPs to speak to the media. So we're not hearing much from that party. Ethnic MPs do definitely tend to be more vocal.
The media has opened up in Myanmar, but there are dangers. Running afoul of Telecommunications Law 6060 for, quote, acts detrimental to the state, community peace, and tranquility can result in a 7 to 15 year jail sentence.
We are seeing journalists be arrested, particularly sensitive to criticize the army. It's very difficult for media to do that.
There is much discussion now on how and with whom to engage to reduce the present state of internal conflict in the country. Sweden has won a place as a non-permanent member of the United Nations Security Council, and there's high expectations on what they might do on Myanmar, says Swedish MP Åsa Eriksson.
As we can see, we're not doing enough because the situation is like it is. I think that the Swedish government has been very clear in our opinion to the regime in Myanmar. And I also think that we will bring up this subject in the Security Council.
Dr. Muang Zarni, a writer and activist from Myanmar who now lives in the UK, also addressed the hearing. He believes that trying to reform military generals is futile, and the international community has to change its approach.
The generals do not look at development the way we do, because the public welfare is not what drives their policies or what motivates them to keep the country together. It is power.
While the European Union has opted to work with the generals and welcomed increased business investment, Sweden is instead working to strengthen Myanmar's democratic institutions. But that doesn't give any solace to the family of Kony, who says he was targeted because of his influence and close relationship with Aung San Suu Kyi. Human rights groups have called for a thorough and independent investigation into his assassination. For Asia Calling, this is Rick Wasserman in Sweden.
With a culture defined by racism and troublemaking, you might not think that people in Asia would identify with skinheads. But in the Indonesian capital, there is a thriving skinhead subculture, and it's not what you might expect. From Jakarta, Asia Taylor has more.
Ute is one of Indonesia's first skinheads, and this is a song by his band, The End. Skinheads are normally seen as swastika-wearing neo-Nazis that yell racist abuse on the street, but the scene here is pretty different. Indonesian skinheads like Ute stand for equality and working-class values.
Skinhead is different with a Nazi skinhead. A Nazi skinhead or racist skinhead is a bonehead. Skinhead is a way of life. Skinhead is a working-class hero, something like that.
Since the early 90s, Ute has pioneered the skinhead scene in Jakarta, beginning with a skinhead record label and a clothing store, both named The Warriors. He's got a song about that too. We are our warriors. We are our warriors. Ute explains how he got into skinhead culture in the first place.
I came in here before, it's no skinhead at all. Yeah, before I study in Singapore, and I got the skinhead Bible from Singapore, and I bring it to my friend in Jakarta, and we talk about these books, and it's bigger and bigger.
He brought it back to Indonesia and introduced it to the punk scene, and the skinhead subculture has grown since, but with an Indonesian twist.
This is subculture from UK, right? This is the originary, but when they came in Indonesia, and like a mixed culture with Indonesian culture or something like that, yeah. We adopt fashion, we adopt ideology maybe, we adopt a way of life, something like that. But it's like in UK, right? They mix with the Jamaican culture and become a skinhead, right?
In Indonesia, the skinhead scene seems to be more about brotherhood, the music, and the fashion. At this concert in the capital, the room is filled with guys in mohawks and denim jackets with silver studs. A punk band from Texas, The Elected Officials, is headlining the event, playing alongside other punk and skinhead bands. Vocalist of the band, Texan Sophie Ruzmania, shared her thoughts of the scene before getting up on stage. She talks about the Oi subculture, which is a mixture of punk and skinhead music.
So, from what I understand, is that a lot of the Oi skinhead culture here, it's more kind of a brotherhood and of a camaraderie and of loving the music and and kind of a lot of ideology and less about exclusion or violence or nationalism, which you see in other parts of the world.
The skinhead scene first emerged in the United Kingdom in the late 1960s. Most people don't know, but it was actually Jamaican immigrants who played a big role in the early beginnings of the scene. The Jamaicans were known as the Rude Boys. There were also the working class mods that rode scooters, wore Doc Marten boots, and listened to punk rock. These groups joined together to become skinheads. But declining economic conditions in the 1970s meant less jobs, and the white working class man blamed this on immigrants. So the fusion of cultures and races that first inspired the skinhead movement is at odds with what the movement later became. By the late 70s, the neo-Nazi skinhead movement had spread throughout Europe and North America. But Ute says Indonesian skinheads have nearly nothing in common with these groups.
Being racist is not cool. Yeah, because we are human is like equal. Yeah, our human is like the same. Yeah. In my religion.
Indonesian skinheads identify with the origins of the movement, like when the Jamaicans were heavily involved. Desi is Indonesian, but she married a Canadian skinhead and is back visiting Jakarta. For more than a decade, she has called herself a skinhead and even has the word skin girl pride tattooed across her chest.
I don't know. The first time I meet the punk, and I still teenager, I still in high school. I hang out around with the punk and skinhead, and I learn which one. I meet some men and they teach me about the Bible skinhead, the book. And I think I choose the skinhead. I don't know why, but I feel I like the skinhead more than punk. Because they're working and they're not lazy, they're clean, smart.
Like skinheads around the world, Indonesian skinheads stand for their country and sing about political issues.
Yeah, my band is about having a loud, having a say about pride for my country, saying about unity, brotherhood, saying about working class. Working class.
Here in Indonesia, the skinhead community focuses their energy on music and their community. Don't be frightened by the name. These skinheads are just here to have fun. For Asia Calling, this is Asia Taylor in Jakarta.
You're listening to Asia Calling on KBR. Since January this year, at least five bloggers and activists have disappeared in Pakistan. That includes poet and university professor Salman Haider, who is known for his vocal criticism of religious extremism and government abuse of opposition activists. The others that vanished were deeply critical of the government and the military too. From Karachi, Naeem Sohutra reports on the chilling repercussions of speaking your mind in Pakistan.
There is shock and anger in Karachi after five bloggers mysteriously vanished. On January 4, Vakash Guraya, a Netherlands-based student, and Asim Saeed, a Singapore-based IT manager, were abducted in the eastern city of Lahore. 2 days later, Salman Haider, a poet, activist and lecturer, was abducted in the capital, Islamabad. Then on January 7, activist Samar Abbas went missing in Islamabad too. Renowned activist Shima Kirmani joined this protest in Karachi. The disappearances are shocking, she says, and undemocratic. The bloggers were well known for their liberal and leftist positions, including speaking out against the government and the military and its campaign of enforced disappearances. Pakistani intelligence agencies are accused of using enforced disappearances in war against ethnic Baloch nationalists.
This is a new trend, and I think it's a very disturbing development because earlier we had been recording and reporting on enforced disappearances of nationalists in Balochistan and to some extent in Sindh. But these people were primarily fighting for political rights. And suddenly we see people from the social media, and all this while we believed that the internet gave you a lot of freedom and space to express yourself.
That's Zohra Yusuf, the chairperson of the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, or HRCP. Enforced disappearances are not new in Pakistan, even though such incidents are rarely reported in the mainstream press or discussed in open forums. But the recent disappearances of bloggers this year has raised eyebrows outside the country, with United Nations and European Union both condemning the reports. Pakistani blogger Gibran Nasir says the disappearances send a chilling sign to the online community.
This incident has definitely caused a lot of panic and frenzy, and that's why from day one I've said that this is an act of terror, because abducting people without any rhyme or reason does cause terror amongst the masses, and hence people have been forced to shut off their own accounts, go, you know, underground as far as online media is concerned, not communicate with people, become wary of people who approach them or who they already know online, but not sure if they are tracing them or tracking them or monitoring them or whether they're really their friends. Various kind of paranoias have crept in.
Pakistan, which now has more than 30 million internet users, has seen a tremendous growth in the social media in the recent years. But in global rankings, the country is among the 10 worst for the internet freedom.
Assalamu alaikum, dosto. Aaj jo jis cheez pe hum baat karne ja rahe hain wo hai jo pure Pakistan mein bhi aur puri duniya
mein. A few kilometers away from the demonstration in Karachi, a group of young bloggers has gathered in a secret venue. Wearing colorful jeans and t-shirts, they are strategizing on how online campaigns can highlight the plight of persecuted and marginalized groups. Among them is 25-year-old Cynthia Johnson, who is constantly using her smartphone. A doctor in training by day, the Christian woman is an active blogger by night.
Blogging is free exchange of data points that one experiences, which other people can pass on, shape it, add on, pass on, which helps us to, you know, understand the truth. It's easy and ubiquitous because of the internet. It's everywhere. Everyone has access to it.
With 130 members, Johnson's group has highlighted issues the national media doesn't regularly cover, like attacks on religious minorities such as Christians and Hindus. But there are definitely dangers to speaking out. Back at the protest, activists from an Islamic religious group have turned up and they are clashing with demonstrators and accusing them of supporting blasphemers. Over recent weeks, reports have emerged that three of the bloggers have returned home, two of them who have since fled the country in fear and two still missing. As for the Pakistani bloggers community, well, they are keeping a very low profile. For Asia Calling, this is Naim Sohotra in Karachi, Pakistan.
Finally, on Asia Calling, from a mountaintop school playing with overhead projectors and classroom scraps to a professional puppet troupe in Manila, the Anino Collective has been producing shadow puppets for 20 years. Nicole Kirby recently met members of the collective at the International Puppet Festival in the Indonesian city of Yogyakarta to talk art, evolution, and the shadows of history. A note that the music that you'll hear in this story is from Filipino artists Pinik Pican and Joy Ayala.
A shimmering blue light swallows the room, as intricate images of fish and sea creatures swim across the walls. Traditional Filipino music is playing, but it's got a modern political twist. A crowd is watching the shadow puppetry of Filipino collective Enino.
So the nice thing about being Enino, being a puppetry group in the Philippines, is that we are not bound by tradition. And so we invent, we play a lot. We can develop our own stories, we can develop our own techniques of puppetry.
That's Dato Arenello. He's one of the longest standing members of the 20-year-old puppet collective. Unlike their neighbours in Asia, the Philippines doesn't have a tradition of shadow puppetry. They're influenced by Indonesian traditions and personal experiences. Here's Dato again.
We bring into Enino our own personal experiences with shadow play. Personally, I've been doing puppetry since I was a kid.
And my name is Andrew, and my introduction to shadow play is we play with shadows using our blanket, white blankets, and then our flashlights. Because in the Philippines, especially during the 90s, and we always have blackouts, electricity is out, so we have to entertain ourselves or else we're going to die. So we improvise by using candles. And we learn it by seeing the lights and then seeing our shadows. And then we explore in it and play with it. And we created our own television show. Cheaper and more practical.
Enino has turned this kind of play into an art form. Just like they did as kids, Enino cuts shapes with paper and cardboard. They use pieces of cellophane, plastic, and whatever is around that can reflect light. Here's puppeteer Teta Tule.
Enino uses a philosophy called aesthetics of poverty. So most of our images, most of the materials that we use are really what we really have on hand, recycled materials or whatever you have there. Whatever you grab as a tool, you can wield it to really mean something for the audience and for us as a collective.
Enino started in a school outside Manila. In the 1980s and 90s, overhead projectors were found in every school and church across the Philippines and many other parts of the world.
Most of the shows that we've produced over the years are all very much dependent on the OHP, our overhead projector, and tailored for it.
Enino started using overhead projectors creatively, magnifying finely cut cardboard puppets and projecting moving lights. And over time, they've become addicted to the machine.
The overhead projector actually allows us to tour, to travel, because we don't have to create huge puppets. So everything is at a small scale. So all our materials can fit in one travel suitcase. And then a projector is optional. If the venue can provide the projector, that's good. A show can be made portable because of that.
You can do a tour with just carry-on baggage.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Enino usually addresses environmental issues. But after 20 years of performances, the collective made its first explicitly political statement in this show. One vignette featured a tiny bird and its mother being hunted and killed by a rifle. A symbol of generations of innocent victims that suffered under martial law and through decades of extrajudicial killings. Here's Teta and fellow artist Hazel.
And I think as really as artists, where do we stand as artists? We can't just give a, wow, it's a beautiful show, but what are we talking about? So
we have to make a stand.
Yeah, especially now that this is happening in the country. This is happening to the Philippines.
Since the new president was elected, extrajudicial killings have skyrocketed. This time, it's suspected drug users and dealers that are being targeted. Then, there was the controversial hero's burial of the former dictator Ferdinand Marcos in November last year. It's seen Anino consider art as a form of resistance, a safeguard against cultural amnesia.
We know that in the history of the Philippines also, there are many artists throughout the years that who have stood up and raised their voices, raised their fists even, and marched in the streets. But of course, they were victims of extrajudicial killings eventually. So now that this issue has resurfaced, people now are exposing, or artists now are looking at their history, looking back, looking at the what really happened in the, particularly in the 70s during martial law.
In Yogyakarta, this is Nicole Kirby for Asia Calling.
That's all for this edition of Asia Calling. Our program today was produced in the studios of Radio KBR in Jakarta, Indonesia. To find out more about our show, send us a message on our Asia Calling Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Asia Calling. You can now also podcast the show, go to the iTunes store and search for Asia Calling, and subscribe for free to our weekly episodes. I'm Kate Lam, back next week with more stories from Asia.
Then you arrived all of a sudden.